Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Kate Young.
It keeps you from dying, and it connects you.
Coming up on our show, a phone conversation with Alton Brown on the power of food to connect and the impact that social media and the food entertainment industry has on home cooking. From Harvest Public Media, we have a story about a labor shortage in the ag industry and a push for a guest worker program. Plus, ideas for changing farm landscapes to help protect honeybees from dangerous chemicals. All that and a snappy green bean recipe. So stay tuned to Earth Eats. We've got some news first from Mark Chilla. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Kate. So the big story this week is the sweeping climate report from U.S. government researchers. The new report has underscored what is already widely accepted among climate scientists. Human activities are the main drivers of climate change. The report, named Volume 2 of the National Climate Assessment, has been in the works for years and includes research from more than 13 federal agencies. The final version is slated to be published in December of next year. The draft concludes that it is extremely likely that human influence has been the dominant cause of the observed warming since the mid-20th century. It cites recent record-breaking weather extremes, melting Arctic ice, and three of the warmest years ever recorded. Researchers also outlined several predictions from a previous report in 2014 that have now come true, including increased coastal flooding, warming oceans disrupting fisheries, receding permafrost, and a long list of damaging effects on agriculture. The report also estimates the cost of extreme climate events at $1.1 trillion since 1980. So that's where we're at, Kate.
Okay, well, thanks, Mark. It takes a lot of people to get food to your table, including workers who are often not U.S. citizens. Yet ag businesses are hungry for a large labor force, so they've introduced a plan to create a federal law to allow undocumented workers to stay in the U.S., despite tough anti-immigration talk from Washington. Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe reports.
If you eat beef, chances are some of what you've eaten grew up here on this feedlot in southwest Kansas. What looks like a dozen football fields laid out on the dusty high plains. On this hot summer morning, two cowboys on horseback are moving cattle. It's one of the largest cattle feeding operations in the U.S. with 400 employees. But the feedlot owner says it's difficult to attract workers in an area this remote, where the unemployment rate hovers around 2%.
There literally are not people to fill these open positions. We need all the people we can get, and regardless of where they come from.
Even though she says all of her employees are documented, the owner didn't want to be identified for fear she'd attract immigration officials. U.S. agriculture relies on immigrant labor to pick produce, work meatpacking lines, and staff feedlots and dairies. Yet half of the farm workers in this country are undocumented. That's why this Kansas feedlot owner, among many others, want federal reforms that would keep undocumented workers here.
Yes, we're big on lawful presence is the term we've been using. We need a way to keep immigrants to gain a lawful presence.
Despite all the anti-immigration talk in the U.S. during the last few years, there are businesses and even members of the Trump administration who support getting legal status for undocumented farm workers. Sonny Perdue, President Trump's agriculture secretary, told Harvest Public Media this spring that he's working on a plan to allow undocumented workers to stay in the U.S. and that Trump supports it.
He understands that they are long-term immigrant, sometimes undocumented immigrant laborers out here on the farms, many of them that are doing a great job contributing to the economy of the United States.
Politics making strange bedfellows, many liberals and conservatives are opposing Perdue's proposal. Colorado immigration attorney Dan Kowalski jokingly calls Perdue's plan agnesty, or agricultural amnesty. He compares it with what a lot of employers already use, visas that allow workers into the country seasonally, but tie them to a single employer. Here's Kowalski via Skype.
What I'm afraid of is that some employers or industries are longing for a return to a more plantation type of situation where you have low paid, hardworking employees who are really trapped.
One of the nation's leading anti-immigrant voices is in Kansas, Secretary of State Kris Kobach. He also heads Trump's voting commission. Kobach says any legalization of undocumented workers is amnesty, and he opposes it. He points to a 1986 amnesty offered under President Reagan that attracted more than a million immigrants, many using phony documents.
If we had another amnesty, it would have the same two consequences. You'd see massive fraud, and you'd see people surging into the United States illegally.
Despite opposition, the plan to replace the federal ag immigration visa is gaining ground. A bill introduced by Virginia Republican in October would create an agricultural guest worker program, upping the number of workers allowed in, easing red tape, and including not just seasonal workers, but those who work year-round in feedlots and dairies.
Well, our motivation is really for the families of our employees.
That feedlot owner in Southwest Kansas says she's concerned that reports of arrests and mass deportations will mean losing her workforce. If someone in an employee's family doesn't have papers, she says the entire family may return to their home country out of fear.
They want the American dream that everyone else has. They want to live here, they want to work here, and provide for their families.
Major ag groups like the American Farm Bureau are backing the new guest worker plan, but the bill has just begun a long journey on Capitol Hill. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
More ag news available at harvestpublicmedia.org. Alton Brown, Food Network star, cookbook author, and host of the food science show Good Eats, is on tour with an action-packed variety show called Alton Brown, Eat Your Science. He'll be here in Bloomington, Indiana on November 12th, and I spoke with him on the phone a few weeks ago. It's wonderful to have you on the phone, and we're excited about your upcoming visit to Bloomington.
Glad to be coming.
So you're on the second leg of Alton Brown, Eat Your Science Tour, and you'll be in Bloomington on November 14th. What kinds of things can we expect from your show?
Well, the best way that I can put it, it is a culinary variety show. There are a couple of really, really big, very, very unusual culinary demonstrations. There's live music. There's I guess I shouldn't really call it stand-up comedy because it's only comedy if people laugh and you never do know. There's a lot of audience interaction. There's a game show component. It's a variety show.
I understand there's a fair amount of audience participation in the show.
Oh, yeah. Volunteers do all the heavy lifting on the show. It's volunteers. That's absolutely, absolutely true.
So you're also asking for participation with the hashtag AB Road Eats.
Yes. AB Road Eats, we have a different hashtag for every town, and about 12 hours or so before we hit that town, we tabulate all of those votes, and that's where I go during the day of the show. Every bite that I eat, every cup of coffee, and there are a lot of them, goes through this hashtag. You know, it's funny when you go to a place and like an entire community says, "Oh, you've got to go here." They may not always be voting for a place that tastes good to an objective bystander, but a place that is meaningful and important to that community. So very often there's something else going on. You know, I'm not looking for Michelin star restaurants here. But even then, it's meaningful, which is more what I'm after. It's mm-hmm. like a first date with that town. I'm trying to get to know that audience before I get on that stage at night. It's almost like a trait of hospitality. You know, you may not be inviting me to your home. You may not even invite me into your town because I was coming anyway. But you're kind of inviting me into these restaurants. And that is an act of hospitality. And, or at least I take it as such. And that's critically important to how I am with that town, how I function while I'm there, and selfishly also it's generally what I remember. I'll remember where I ate this or where I had this cup of coffee, and I obsessively collect coffee mugs. So I have like 100 coffee mugs from all these coffee shops, and I can think of it like, I remember that town, you know. So that's why we do it. Part of it's about community. It's just another way of sharing food, and I want to give people the opportunity to share what they're proud of, what they love, what they like about their edible community, as it were. I want them to be able to share that with me.
That is a really great lead-in to my next question. I worked for years in a food pantry as a nutrition educator, and I was basically sharing recipes with people and doing cooking demonstrations. We also grew food on site in a garden. And somewhere along the line, we realized that food was really the vehicle for connecting with people about a lot of other issues and a way to really break out of the isolation that so often goes hand in hand with poverty and food insecurity. And I was just wondering if you could share your thoughts on food and connection and the power of food to connect people.
The only power that it actually has besides keeping our bodies moving. It is connective tissue. Why do you think we still care about it? Why do you think we still watch it? You know, Instagram practically exists because we're still trying to find ways to connect with each other through food. The end result of how that relationship changes because of technology is yet to be determined, but it is constantly changing. But all of this happens because we crave that connectivity, and nothing does it like food. It is global. It is part of the human foundation of the human experience. So when people have asked me, well, why did you quit, you know, directing commercials to make these, you know, short films about food that turned into what, you know, to this show called Good Eats? I'm like, because it is an infinitely interesting subject, and because it connects human beings. We need it. We need that connectivity, and we don't have it in many aspects of our lives anymore. We can't agree on politics. We can't agree on, you know, on religion. There's so many things, and our culture is so fragmented because of the internet, because of social media. It allows us to socialize only with those of us that see the world exactly as we do. We all live in these teensy, teensy little bubbles. Food breaks those bubbles. What you say about your experience absolutely resonates with me. You are 100% right, and I would argue that is in and of itself the entirety of the power of food. It keeps you from dying, and it connects you. It's connective tissue. It is the connective tissue.
I know that in recent years, Michael Pollan has noted that millions of Americans are now spending more time watching celebrities and competitors prepare food on TV than we're actually preparing it ourselves. And our fascination with food shows increased, but our cooking at home seems to have decreased. Could you comment on the potential downsides of turning cooking into a spectator sport?
First off, I think he's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's wrong. I think he was looking for evidence of something and found evidence to satisfy the hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
My findings are different because I'm stopped in the street every day of my life, pretty much, by people that say, that tell me about their cooking and tell me about how they weren't cooking. I'm not saying it's everybody, and I do think that there are downsides to turning food into a spectator sport. But I don't agree with Mr. Pollan across the board. And I have, you know, what I would consider a priori knowledge of that. The downsides, though, are whenever you fetishize something, your relationship to it changes. Do I worry that there are people that aren't cooking at all and don't even think of cooking as something they can do? Yes, mm-hmm. Because there are people like that. There are people for which even the flavor of food doesn't matter anymore. It's only whether it's Instagrammable or not.
Uh-huh.
That's a huge concern to me. People will take a photo of food and Instagram it before they taste it. Think about how crazy that is. Because ultimately now, we're not eating anymore, we're consuming.
Brown admits that Pollan's concerns are well-founded, but oversimplified. He says that, yes, he is worried.
And I'm worried about my role in it, trust me. I know a person who's been threaded all the way through this, and it's called me. And I've been doing this for 18 years, and I've been there. I hosted a show called Cutthroat Kitchen. That ain't got nothing to do with home cooking, okay? I've got no prediction other than we need to slow down and seriously think about where we're going and to understand that all forms of media change our relationship to the thing, to you to that thing. So, you know, you pick up a hammer, everything in your world changes. You get on a bicycle, everything in the world changes. You pick up a smartphone and go on Instagram, everything changes. And when you're dealing with rudimentary relationships, like our relationship to food, the power of those changes are things that we can't even begin to understand. And the ramifications may not even show themselves for 20 or 30 years, but they will be profound.
We talked about how much of Brown's work has focused on overcoming barriers to cooking.
Good Eats was always about making things accessible and doable and giving people different tools and different mindsets in which to take on this thing that we call cooking. And in the end, a lot of us are still just trying to make up for the fact that, you know, our parents don't teach us to cook anymore. Our grandparents don't teach us to cook anymore. And you know, kids go off to college now not knowing how to fry an egg. And so we're surrogate parents. We're surrogate, you know, we're the people trying to now pass on that. And the bigger problem is, as simply as technology changes, it's harder and harder to stay on that mission, to stay on that. Let's face it, we're now looking at galaxy cakes and unicorn frappuccinos more than we are at actual food. Because again, what we want is clickability. Flavor, secondary. And unless it's in, you know, particular realms of social media. You get my point.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I'm completely guilty of it, too.
Well, understand your role in it. You know, all of these things, you know, these are all just, they're all tools. They're all methods of expression, but we have to be responsible with what we do it, or at least thoughtful. If not responsible, thoughtful. And I'm sorry, you just got me on something that I happen to at the moment. I've been really chewing on this issue for a while and dealing with it and struggling with it.
Well, I do. I appreciate you answering it and going in.
Well, I don't know that I actually gave you an answer. I don't feel that I did, because I don't know that I have one yet. I don't know that I do.
Alton Brown has been and will be on the road for many, many days. I wondered how he copes. What are some of your tricks for staying sane and feeling good on the road?
It comes down to exercise and sleep. Those two things, you know, you got to get rest and you got to get exercise. And it's not easy, especially when you're doing something like AB Road Eats, where, like, first thing in the morning, I'm not jogging. I'm going out to wherever I'm supposed to be having coffee that my fans want me to go. So, and the other thing is, I don't drink alcohol when I'm on tour. It's just too easy to have that get out of hand.
Yeah.
So no alcohol for me on the road. No more of my beloved cocktails, no martinis, no nothing. Coffee. I can have all the coffee I want.
That sounds like a plan.
And I'm going to have a good time, and I certainly hope that the audience does as well. I hope you guys will come out.
Alton Brown Eat Your Science comes to Bloomington November 14th at the IU Auditorium. If you're local, you can let him know your favorite spot for a cup of coffee or a cup of soup by using the hashtag #ABRoadEatsBloomington on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. And you know you can follow us on Twitter, @EarthEats. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. NeedMoreRoasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Pesticide use on corn and soybeans can harm beneficial insects, especially pollinators like bees. Instead of limiting farmers' pesticide use, a team of researchers at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln is looking to tackle the problem another way, by designing agriculture landscapes with pollinator health in mind. For Harvest Public Media, Ariana Brocious reports.
If you've been paying attention to the widespread decline of the nation's bee populations, you may have heard this one long word, neonicotinoids.
Neonicotinoids is actually a class of insecticides.
That's Judy Wu Smart, an assistant professor and extension specialist in pollinator health at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Corn and soybean crops don't rely on bees and butterflies, but insecticides don't discriminate. Wu Smart says neonicotinoids are different from other pesticides because the toxic chemicals move throughout the entire plant and can collect in the soil.
So they're useful in agricultural production because they can protect plants from root-damaging insects and pests where spray applications may not reach them. But they're concerning for pollinators because bees that are foraging on plants that have been contaminated with neonicotinoids can be getting it directly through nectar and pollen.
Most commercial corn and soybean seeds now have a pesticide coating that can become airborne and drift onto plants bees rely on, like flowering trees and shrubs that grow along roadsides or in field corners. Wu Smart says corn planting coincides with spring blooming, drawing bees in at a time when they're even more likely to get pesticide exposure. Neonicotinoids can have a variety of effects on bees, damaging things such as
foraging, learning, memory, cognitive functions that really inhibit the colony from developing well. They can have effects on the queen's ability to lay eggs and produce brood.
So, her goal is to figure out how farm fields could be redesigned to limit or prevent pesticide drift and provide protected pollinator habitat. In other plains and Midwestern states, researchers are having farmers plant prairie strips between fields to help combat water contamination from pesticides and fertilizer. At UNL, researchers are a year into a five-year project to study which landscape tools, like windbreaks, pollinator habitat, and cover crops, make the most sense. They're also trying to figure out what would make those practices appealing to farmers, says Gary Bentrup.
And as a general rule, I find that edge-of-field practices, kind of like what we're suggesting, are usually more palatable than changing an operation in field.
Bentrup is a research landscape planner at the USDA's National Agroforestry Center in Lincoln. He's looking into the role of windbreaks, rows of trees planted along fields. He says the basic idea is that a row of non-pollinator-friendly plants can act as a shield between crops treated with neonicotinoids and pollinator-friendly plants on the other side.
Evergreens are generally a good choice for that. They're fine. Leaves and branching structures are effective at trapping pesticide drift.
The roots of the trees can also help filter pesticides in the soil. But increasingly, farmers are removing windbreaks to allow for more sprinkler irrigation. So Bentrup says it's important to consider the multiple benefits of landscape design, including economic ones.
Research has shown that windbreaks can increase corn yields about 13%, soybean yields about 15%, winter wheat by 23%.
Bentrup says many farmers recognize the importance of bees to pollinate everything from apples to almonds to avocados. Wu Smart says there's also a big effort by groups concerned about pollinator survival to establish more habitat, including around farms. They hope this research will help provide ways to make that more successful.
Not just to look at what hurts and what harms pollinators, but to look at the ecosystem as a whole and look at how we can find that balance between agricultural production and ecosystem functions and beneficial insect communities.
That could be good for farmers and bees. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Ariana Brocious.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public broadcasters in the Plains and Midwest covering agriculture and other rural issues.
Today we pulled a fun idea for green beans from the Earth Eats archive. Green beans tempura. Green bean fries, or basically deep-fried green beans. They make for fabulous finger food or an interesting side. If you don't have a deep fryer, a heavy pot like a Dutch oven plus a thermometer works great. Chef Bob Adkins, formerly a Farm Bloomington restaurant, walks us through the steps.
Where are we doing this at? Right here? Back by the fryer. Back by the fryer. Yes, Chef. I'm going to the fryer. This is where the magic happens. The deep fry. This is where the thousands and thousands of our farm-famous Parmesan and garlic chili fries come from. Deep fat, lots of calories, but if done correctly, deep fat frying can actually be fairly healthy. It doesn't absorb a lot of oil and grease if you don't have a real thick batter. And if you do the appropriate steps so it doesn't absorb the oil, Basically, you're just immersing it into a really hot environment and steaming it from the inside out. So, we're going to start by making our batter. And you want to make your batter not too far in advance. No more, really, than an hour or so. So, starting with some all-purpose flour, we're going to add to this cornstarch. And the cornstarch makes things extra crisp and light. We're going to add a little bit of sugar for some sweetness. Add some salt. If we wanted to, we could add any number of things to this. We could put some cayenne, we could put some chili powder, some sesame seeds, some sesame oil, things like that. I mean, this is just, like we like to do here, we like to take a really basic recipe and then we build on that. And I think that's what all good cooks should do at home as well. So I'm just using my hand, mixing all my dry ingredients together. And then I have one beaten egg. Get really beat up together there. Some tempura recipes don't call for any egg, but this is just going to ensure that it's going to stick and stay together in the fryer. And then we're going to add some beer to our dry ingredients. That was about a cup of really ice cold beer, nice and cold. If you don't have the beer, you could use soda water. And the consistency is like a little bit thicker than crepe batter, a little thinner than pancake batter. It's okay if you got a few clumps. I'm using my hands here just to make sure, you know, I'm getting them pretty well. So it should coat your fingers when you come up out of the batter.
You don't need to stick to green beans. Try onion rings, strips of winter squash, okra, thin slices of eggplant. Get creative. We've got all the recipe details at eartheats.org. Now we're ready for the deep fryer.
All right, so. Okay, 350 degree fat. Just gonna drop these in one by one. You don't want them to clump together in the fryer. And you can see they've got this beautiful light brown batter on them, but you can still see a little bit of the green. So now out of the oil, and then we're gonna just put them onto a plate or into a bowl lined with a little bit of paper towel. Soak up any extra fat or grease. And then we'll just dust a little bit of kosher salt right over that, and then dip them in whatever you want.
Well, I sure do love those green beans, but I don't like them from a can.
We've got plenty of dipping sauce ideas on our website, eartheats.org. And you'll find this recipe there too, all the steps. Production support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. NeedMoreRoasters.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Big thanks to the Earth Eats team, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Farm Bloomington Restaurant, Harvest Public Media, and Indiana University Food Institute. Our executive producer is John Bailey. This is Kate Young. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats. See you next week.